This is the seventh public talk given by Sri Jay Krishnamurti at Madras on the 6th January 1965. As this is the last talk, at least for this year, I would like, if I may, to talk about what is a religious mind. I like to go into it rather deeply and investigate together into this whole question of man's search for something beyond his own petty limitations, trying to find something beyond his own measure, and to share, go into it together, the word religion must be clearly understood by both of us, both by the speaker as well as by you who are listening. Because man, from what anthropologists have said, have discovered through these 2 million years and more perhaps, man has always sought some deity, some divinity, something other than this transient world. And always has created out of his imagination, out of his search for something permanent, something which is not easily destructible. He created images or symbols or the images created by the mind. He either carved out of stone an image according to his own imagination, according to his poetry of life, according to his limitations and fears, hopes, and all the travail of life. And having established an image carved by the hand or by the mind, he begins to worship it, to give it day after day flowers, go to it regularly, look to it as a protection against the weather, against death, against disease and the various calamities that man is heir to. And out of this constant search for a savior, for a God that is not bred by imagination, by thought, he's always sought through rituals, through going to the temple, day after day, following certain mold, certain patterns, certain formulas, and get himself lost, if necessary, in some form of mysticism, some vision, some heightened sense of intelligence. And if one wants to really find out, not merely revive a dead past of a culture, because what is revived is something that's already gone, dead, buried, withered. And to worship that and try to revive it in modern world has very little meaning, or hardly any meaning. And yet that's what we do when we can't find an answer to the agony of our life. Then we try to go back to something far away and try to revive, catch hold of it. Through memory, through deep remembrances, through every form of deceit and habits. But it seems to me this revival of the past, this adherence to something that has been well established for centuries, this resorting to temples, to rituals, to organized beliefs, dogmas, with their property, with their enormous wealth, seems to me so utterly fantastic. It has really no meaning at all. If you go into it deeply and observe it for yourself, it has no meaning in our life, our daily active life of misery, despair, insufficiency, and fears. Therefore, to find out for oneself if there is such a thing as not a religion, but a religious mind. To find that out, one must put aside all the nonsense which the priests, which man, the priests with their saviors, with their rituals, with their everlasting repetition of words. We must put all those aside completely and start as though anew. And I believe, and that's the only way to find out. As though organized belief, rituals, the so-called sacred books never existed, that you have never read. And actually they have no meaning in daily life. What has meaning is our daily life of struggle, of misery, of pain, of not being able to go beyond our own limited activity and activities of the body, of the heart, or of the mind. So, to really find out, and one must, because our life is very limited, very petty, circumscribed by so many things, by circumstances, by fears. And is it possible for man to go beyond that? And that's really the fundamental issue. Not whether there is God or no God, whether you believe or don't believe, it doesn't make any difference whether you believe or don't believe. Your belief is the result of your conditions. If you are born as a Muslim, Christian, a Hindu, your society shapes your thinking, your belief, your thoughts, your feelings. And in the communist world, they don't believe in it at all. They think you are talking sheer nonsense. So, to really find out, one must not only put away from oneself, operate surgically, all this nonsense. And it is sheer nonsense. Doesn't matter who says it. And having put away these absurdities of so-called religion with its rituals, with his mutterings, whether in Latin or in Sanskrit, and to put away all this so that you can face reality of what is. So, if we would take this journey together, not abstractly, not in theory, not listen to a talk and follow the words and think perchance that you've got something out of it. All that has no meaning at all. What has meaning is to explore, and in the very act of exploration bring about a radical change in daily living. Because that is the basis, that's the foundation on which one can build. The daily living with its agonies, with its boredom, with its loneliness, with its fear, with its unseeable future, lived. Every day and investigate, explore. And to explore, you need passion. You need tremendous vitality, energy. And very few have energy. Or rather, the passion for to inquire. Because we are so easily satisfied. We are, most of us in the modern world are discontented with almost everything, with the family, with the job, with the routine of life, the loneliness, completely discontented. And if we are, we try to find an action, either through organizations, social reform, political reform, or a religious reform, always reforming, or putting, not entering that kind of activity, one goes within oneself. As the monks are supposed to do. But they don't know, they don't go within themselves at all. They have all the outward appearance of a simple life. But the simple life begins only when you have put away dogma, belief, and authority. Then you can go within. But the going within is very difficult. It requires energy. And as we were saying, Very few people have energy of this kind. There is energy created through friction, through resistance, through battle with oneself, conflict, and that engenders a certain form of energy. As one can see, you want something, you go after it. You are miserable, you are unhappy, you cannot get on with your wife or husband, you battle. And that very resistance, battling, gives a form of energy, which is really hate, envy, greed. And discontent is so easily satisfied. You find some channel through which you can fulfill yourself or your hopes, fears, and you are satisfied immediately. But to keep this discontent at its highest, keep it hot, burning, without finding any chance. And to keep it terribly alive, one must inquire into oneself and discover that energy which has no motive. And that's what we are going to do for May this evening. Discover for ourselves if there is a passion, an energy, a very simple way of looking at life without battle, without conflict, without seeking an aim. To do that, one must go within oneself when one cannot go within oneself except by going through outward activity and then moving from there inward. Without understanding the world, the society, your relationship as a human being to that world, to that society, your job, your wife, your family, your word, your gesture, outwardly, you cannot begin to go inwardly without understanding your relationship to the world. And that's very difficult too. Nothing is easy in life. Nothing. But most of us want a quick answer, a quick way of getting all this over and coming to some extraordinary mystical state which is really illusory. So we must begin to find out the meaning and the significance of our outward activities. Because that's the only test you have. You can't deceive there, yourself there. You know whether you are hate, whether you are bored, whether you are deceiving others or deceiving yourself, whether you are frightened, whether you are happy, whether you are creating in this world something not out of your own self-centered activity. If we have no criterion as a test from the outside, how can you go within yourself and discover the most extraordinary complex entity with all the deceptions, motives, anxieties. It's to go within, and to go very far within, you must go. You must look from the outside. You must look to the outside and find out. That is, as the tide goes out and the same waters come in, so must we. We must ride on the tide which goes out, which is our relationship to the world. And then, having understood that, ride on that water and move within. So we have to look to our relationship to the world. Our relationship begins with the family, the wife, the husband, the children. That's the world you live in. You have to find your relationship. You have to find out what it is based on. Not deceive yourself. What is it actually based on? Habit? Sex? Certain traditions? A narrow little circle? And we live in that. The family, which is composed of the husband, wife and children, and there we dominate or are dominated. Sexually, emotionally, or dependent. Please, you observe yourself. You are not merely listening to a lot of words. Because we can build up a lot of words. And that doesn't get very far. But if the words reveal the state of your own relationship, the actual relationship, not what you would like your relationship to be with your wife and with your children, but the actual fact, then from there we can move. Because the family is against society, is against human relationship as a whole. You know, it's like living in a big house and living in one part of that house in one little room and living there and making extraordinary thing of that one little room, which is the family. The family has only importance in relation to the whole of the house. That one room is in relation to the whole of the house. So is the family in relation to the whole of human existence. But we separate it. We cling to it. We make much ado about a family. My relations and your relations and battling with each other everlastingly. And the family is like the little room in relation to the whole house. When we forget the whole house, then the family becomes terribly important. And so, the family becomes very important when you forget the whole of human existence. The family has only importance in relationship to the whole of human existence. Otherwise it becomes a terror, a dreadful thing. a monstrous thing. So one has to find out for oneself the fact of the actual relationship. And discover through that relationship, the relationship with your neighbor, with the world, with the extraordinary human beings who are cantankerous, who are mischievous, who are ugly, brutal, tyrannical. And to find that out, you must start very near. And there is this problem also of sex, which has become so astonishingly important for most people, such a complex thing. Because, as we explained the other day, we cannot find other ways of releasing ourselves. And so we turn to one thing and cling to it, make a monstrous issue out of it. And when we say we love the family, we really don't love the family. We don't love our children. Actually, we don't. When we say we love our children, you mean really that they have become a habit, toys, a thing of amusement for a while. But if you loved something, your children, then you would care. You know what caring is? If you care, when you plant a tree, a bush, you care for it, you nourish it, find out the right soil, the right nutriment, right fertilizer, and so on. You care infinitely, you watch it. I do not know if you ever planted a tree, a seedling, water it every day, dig deep before you plant, then see the soil is right, then plant, then water it, then protect. Watch it every day, you look after it as though it was part of your whole being. But we don't love the children that way. If you did, then you would have a different kind of education altogether. There would be no wars. There would be no poverty. They would not, mind then would not be trained to be merely technical. There would be no competition, there would be no nationality. And because we don't love, all this being allowed to grow. Therefore one has to begin with the very near thing and discover from there the actual state of your mind and your being. And that's very difficult to do because we find so many ugly things in ourselves. Conscious as well as unconscious. And we can't face them. So we rather run away, either to a temple, to a cinema, or organized amusement, including the church or the temple, which is organized amusement. And to face something actually demands energy. You have no energy if you are battling uselessly about nothing. And that's what most of us are doing. So, to bring about this passion, this energy, which you need to go very deeply, endlessly, every day and every minute, there are certain things one has to do, obviously. One has to eat right food. Not what your tongue dictates, but the right food, which you can study and all the rest of it, which you don't have to go into. Then one has to understand the urge to obey. Most of us so easily obey. That is, the man who obeys so easily or with great difficulty is seeking power. Please follow this. Why should you obey anybody? You obey your boss in the factory, in your office, because you might lose your job if you assert yourself. You are little more, if you show yourself little more intelligent than the boss, you might lose your job. And there are so many people waiting to get that job. So there is this fear built up, and therefore you obey. So, intelligence is downgraded. Because every one of us is seeking power, position, prestige, status. Watch it. You are doing that in your life, every day. You are not concerned with function alone, but use the function to arrive at a status. And therefore, the status becomes far more important than the function. And hence the battle for status, not for the efficiency of functioning, but what you get out of that function. What position, what power, what prestige, what status. And hence the competition for status, not the to function efficiently. So most of us want power, position, and therefore we obey. Because we'll gradually climb to that status through obedience, and therefore cultivate inefficiency, cultivate this obedience and the fear that goes with it. So, to find out what is a religious mind, we must understand not only the relationship of yourself and the family with society and beyond, we must also understand this whole process of the search for power, which is to dominate, either in the family or in society, or the dominating authority in an organization, religious or otherwise. So the mind must investigate this whole process of authority, which is included law. You must obey law. You must keep to the right side of the road. Is it left side of the road here? You must buy a stamp. But every other form of authority, the psychological authority, must be understood so completely that the mind no longer seeks authority of any kind. So one begins to discover for oneself the nature of a religious mind. He may have a family, but that family is in relationship to the whole and not separate. And because it is not separate, Therefore, it has to be looked after, cared for, and therefore, totally different kind of education. And the inquiry, which begins very near, shows this desire for power, dominance, and this urge to obey, which manifests itself in so many ways, which is disrespect for people and respect for few. If you have no disrespect for anybody, you need not have respect for anybody. Then you are. So, then one can begin to go within oneself, beginning outwardly, being aware of the outward things, of the trees, of the poverty, the reason of the poverty, the whole structure of social, economic structure as it is, and understanding it. We are using that word to understand. We mean not merely analytically, intellectually, verbally, but understanding it. With your blood, with your heart, with your mind, with everything you have, to understand your relationship with your family, to understand with your relationship to power, position, authority, status. Then you can go within. And to go within, one must first understand the principal thing, which is to be terribly honest to oneself, so that there is no deception whatsoever. We deceive ourselves so easily. We'd rather not look. We'd rather talk about something transcendental, God, theories, Atman, the literature, anything but look. You know, when you enter a room and you are so concerned about discussing reality, if there is this and if there is that, you never watch the furniture, the color of the carpet, if there are flowers, what shape of the window it is. You watch nothing. You are so consumed by the otherness. But one has to watch. One has to observe everything. Watch the sunset. Watch the tree against that sunset, the dark, the casuarina with its delicate foliage. Watch it, the light through it, the leaves, its trunk. And if you don't watch that, you cannot watch this. If you don't know how to look, you can't look within. And we have tried to look in by denying the outer, denying the outward beauty of life. All the saints, all your literature never talks about the beauty of life. They tell you how to escape from this misery. And there is tremendous beauty in living. And that beauty is shown in nature. In watching a tree, in being in communion with a tree. And if we do not know how to look there, to look where you are walking, to observe what you are saying outwardly, the gestures you make, the way you show respect and disrespect. If you do not watch that, how can you watch within? So it must begin again outwardly. Then you can go. And to observe, there must be no deception. What is the power that creates, breeds deception? You understand? Why do we deceive ourselves? Why do we put on masks? You know, the mask of a human being when he is capable and efficient in technology. That's a particular mask. He lives in that. He doesn't want to know what is behind that mask. You may be a first-class engineer, first-class bureaucrat. And that's a mask. That mask becomes the respectability, which the world accepts as a marvelous human being. But remove the mask, whether he's of a scientist or an astronomer, remove the mask, he's just like everybody else. So one has to find out for oneself what is it, what is the power, what is the energy that creates deception. You know what I mean? Never to see actually what we are. Actually, not theoretically. Not to be able to see clearly, definitely what you are. Because we are frightened. Because we want to change what we are into something noble or whatever it is. We want to change it. We want to make it supreme. We want to be everything. So the motive of deception begins when you want to change what is. When you are discontented with what is. We are going to go into that. But first we are showing how necessary it is to remove every deception and the means that creates deception so that your mind can look clearly. Because most of us live in deceptions. Which is living on the surface. Just amusing ourselves if you have money or going to the office day after day. Just living on the superficial things and never inquiring. That's also a form of deception. Because you don't live just by bread alone, you live by some or at other levels, at a deeper existence. But if you deny all that, you're also deceiving yourself. So one must become aware of this power to deceive oneself, and that power comes to an end, deception comes to an end, when there is no end, when there is no desire to reach any end but to move from fact to fact. And to look at oneself is possible only when there is no interference of deception. when you can look without the word, without the desire to translate it into according to your own past memories, to look. And that's one of the most difficult and arduous things to do. You know, to look at a tree, to look at a woman, to look at a man, to look at the scholar, to look at, to merely observe. If you can observe without any interpretation, without any energy, without any translation, then from that observation you will find you will have tremendous energy. Because now that energy is being wasted through interpretation, through translating what you see into like or dislike, or trying to alter it according to a social, economic or a religious pattern, or a moral pattern. So this desire to change what is dissipation of energy. Whereas if you looked at what is actually, at your anger, at your jealousy, at your lust, at your violence, without any interpretation, look at it. Then you have energy. So, the religious mind is a mind that has no deception whatsoever, that does not seek any status, any, that has no desire or urge for power of any kind. And the religious mind understands its relationship with the family and with the whole of man. Then we can go deeply, which is, we have only the intellectual instrument, at least that's what is said. But there is the instrument of observation, which is to observe every movement of thought, every movement of feeling. And so, uncover the fears that are hidden, the secret desires that are never looked at. Explore. And to explore, as we said, needs tremendous energy. And this energy is released when you are moving with what you are discovering, not translating what you are seeing in terms of the past. Have you ever wondered how the scientists have extraordinary energy? You know, to go into a laboratory, if you've ever done in your first-class research laboratory, there you will see the man completely full of energy, active. Because he's dealing with outward things, there's no resistance, he's moving from fact to fact. He doesn't indulge in theories, hypotheses and speculations. He's not a theologian, he's a pure, clear-sighted technician watching everything under the microscope. And therefore he's got tremendous energy there in the laboratory. But let him go outside, he's just like everybody else. Anxious, fighting for a position, competing, nationalistic, caught in religious beliefs, or inventing his own particular belief, and so on, so on. There is the waste of energy. And if we could look, and to look, the mind must be completely silent. After all, when the scientist is looking through the microscope or whatever he does, observes, he's observing from silence, not from knowledge. What he sees, then he translates in terms of knowledge and therefore action. But he sees from silence. It may be that silence may last a split second or an hour. And that's the only way to observe. So, the cultivation of a silent mind becomes stupid. It cannot be practiced and you arrive at a silent mind. But you see, to observe, you must have silence. To look at that sunset, do look at it. Look at that sunset, and you can't see it if your mind is chattering. You can see it only completely when the mind is extraordinarily quiet and intense. After all, that is beauty. That is the perception of beauty or non-beauty is only possible when there is passion. When you look at that sunset with complete intensity, and you cannot be intense if you're not silent. So you begin to see how extraordinarily the mind becomes silent when you observe, when you are observing. And you don't have to discipline the mind to be silent. Then it's a dead mind. But the mind that is observing out of silence creates its own discipline. It doesn't need discipline because it's observing. So, this observation out of silence is passion, is energy. Then you can observe your fears. Because most people are frightened of death, frightened of loneliness, frightened of not being loved, frightened of this empty, useless life. And to meet that fear and observe it without any movement, trying to go beyond it or resist it or try to get rid of it. To go beyond it, to overcome it, to suppress it, a waste of energy. Whereas if you observed the whole movement of fear, then that observation out of silence gives energy. Then that problem of fear ceases, because you have the question of time enters into it, and the whole implication of time which we have already talked about. So, from the observation of daily events, we are using the word observation, which is not critical, or the outcome of discontent, or conformity, suppression, but observation out of silence, out of observation of fact only, not the translation of the fact or the opinion about the fact. Then you will see out of this observation there is no effort necessary to do, to resist, to overcome or to deny. Effort altogether goes away. And one can live daily life, going to the office, cooking, doing everything without effort. Because that is the religious mind. The mind that understands the family and its position to the whole. The mind that does not seek power, position. The mind that is not caught in any ritual, any dogma, any belief, any organized church or temple. And that has no power whatsoever to create illusion. And the religious mind is the mind that looks at facts and therefore does not make any effort at all, whatever it does. So then, go still further. That is, by observing the outward things, one has come to the inner. And the outer and the inner are not two different states. They are the same state of observation out of silence. So, this silence is space. Because we live in a very small space. In the space created by the mind with its own ideas, the mind which is the result of its own conditioning to a particular society and culture. It lives in a very small space. And all the battle and all the relationship, all the anxieties are within that little space. But the moment the mind, through observation, has become naturally, easily, without effort, silent, that little space is broken. Because the moment the mind is completely quiet, you will see that there is no limitation to space. We will then see that the object doesn't create the space. There is space, endless. And when that takes place, the mind then is the true religious mind. And from that mind there is activity. You can be super citizen, not running away to a monastery, becoming a sannyasi, or becoming a complete technician, a mechanized human being. But from that effortless, silent observation, there is action. That's the only action that doesn't breed hatred, enmity, competition. Then, through observation and silence, you will see, because there is space, there is love. Love is dying every day. Love is not memory. Love is not thought. Love isn't a thing that continues, has duration in time. And through observation, one must die to the continuity of everything. Then there is love. And with love, there comes creation. You know, creation is one of the most difficult things to understand. The man who writes a poem, however beautiful, thinks he's a creative being. The man and the woman who breed a children think they are creative. Or the man who, or the cook who makes bread. Is perhaps also creative. But creation is something far more. Not the man who merely writes a book or fulfills himself in some petty little ambition. But creation is not man-made structure or man-made technological knowledge and the result of technical knowledge, which is merely invention. Creation is something that is timeless. That has no tomorrow and the past and yesterday, which is living timelessly. And you come to it very naturally if you understand this whole problem of existence. So, religious mind is all these things, and it is in a state which is creative from moment to moment. It's always acting from that extraordinary sense of emptiness. No, I do not know if you have noticed how a drum is always empty. And when you strike on it, it gives the right tone. But it is empty. But our minds are never empty. They're always full. And therefore, our action is always from this dreadful noise of thought, of memory, of despair. And therefore action is always contradictory, leading to great misery. But a mind that's completely empty, empty in the sense observation, silence, and therefore love, and therefore the whole understanding of death and being created, such a mind is empty all the time. It acts from that emptiness. It speaks from that emptiness. And therefore it will always be true. It will never bring about a deception within itself. And it's only such a religious mind that can solve the problems of misery in this world.